Chapter 8 Calico Archives. Returning the portable sampler to its protective case, Toby Effion first glanced around at his mates, then his gaze lifted to admire the distant silhouette of the ship he had come to know so well. The powerful beams projected from the searchlight were directed away from him to cover an area for the second team's activities, allowing Toby to stand there in almost complete darkness. Hundreds of years ago, two stars had blazed past close to his tiny asteroid, leaving the surface charred and highly ionized. Now the binary suns were on the opposite side of the ribbon, completely shrouded from his senses by the dust and debris that had not been ejected by the combined gravity wells as they flew past. The havoc it caused was obvious and the primary reason for investigating this region. Huge circular vortices were visible even to the naked eye, caused by the dance of the brief but powerful gravity wells, distorting the rubble that was electromagnetically locked in a common current. It had been 16 months since the Calico had been launched, and the ship had returned to Earth twice for supplies and much-needed rest. The schedule still did not have replacement personnel, so Toby knew that he would be making at least one more trip, and that was fine with him. Still, the idea of beginning the journey home to Nigeria and his family in a week's time sounded good. "It is very fine," he thought, smiling to himself. This patchy debris field, the good doctor discovered, stretched multiple light years. It was composed of tiny grains of dust, up through the scale of fragments as big as planets. This collection became known as the Ribbon, and it sat on one of the Birkeland current filaments connecting most of the stars in the neighboring cluster. How such a structure could be formed in the first place was up for much debate, but more and better data was what the crew was concentrating on getting. How best to get this data was the reason for the argument that John and Sarah were having with the individuals on the screen. "Look," John said forcefully, "we have to thin out the herd. There are way too many objects that you guys want us to investigate, and we've barely moved since we got to this area. If you have your way, we're going to die of old age before we've gone the distance between the Earth and the Moon." "What is this phrase, thin a herd?" "I do not know this phrase." A young lady addressed the Russian scientist in his own language, and his face lit up in understanding. He quickly pointed out to all participants that his group had the fewest and most interesting of objects selected, and if they were to truly reduce the herd, then his option was the best. This began another round of back and forth, but by now John had enough. "When you guys figure it out, you call me," and he hung up. "Geez, Dad, way to go." "Well, they need to get their ducks in a row," Sarah giggled. "Mika would have liked that line. I do not understand ducks on a road." Her father still wore a look of frustration on his face. "Let's keep going with the next two objects. I want the auto drills and landing crew on both. At this rate, we won't have hit all the rocks in the queue before it's time to leave again," John said, reviewing the spreadsheet in front of him. 38 more days and we'll be on Mars, right? We're going to burn hard." Sarah was basically pleading with her father. "I'm looking forward to getting home. Maybe I can get a life while I'm there." Still studying the display, John's head began nodding his consent. But as realization finally set in, Sarah's comment caused him to look up at her. He knew that everything that had taken place during the time developing the step drive had affected not only her life, but the lives of all who had followed him. "Maybe it is time for her to think about staying put, too. Settling down, maybe starting a family of her own," he thought. John wanted grandkids, and at the rate his daughters were going, he would die seeing them single. This activity was too chaotic, and even he had started thinking it was time to walk away. He could do it. He had achieved his goals, and then took it to the next two levels. Earth was in a good position to explore, and even now, this group of adventurers were getting a lot of good work done. Yeah, 38 more days and we'll be home. Sounded good to him, too. Exiting the conference room, father and daughter were met by two Space Force cadets in body armor, their guns pointed directly at them. "If either of you resist, you're dead," came the growl through the external speaker suit unit. The two were spun around and their sidearms removed and stowed in a satchel. "Now move!" Prodded by the gun barrel, the two prisoners were angled towards the command center of the ship. An arm passed to the left of John, pressed the button, and the door slid open. Both cadets were ready. With a quick push, the prisoners were forced through the entrance, followed by a pair of flashbang simulators that put the entire bridge crew into stunned, injured mode. "Bridge is secure," the leader spoke into the comnet.
"Copy. Engine room secured," came the reply.
"Captain, I urge you to surrender your vessel. Now!" The cadet's threatening voice left little room for interpretation. General Baring, the chief of staff for the Space Force, had been paying close attention to the movements of his personnel during the past half hour. He saw them advance from behind the asteroid cover that they had started from, and he saw them make their approach. Departing their tiny ship, they made the 2-kilometer trek to the Calico in silence. Softly landing on the hull, they made their way to the cargo area that was open for movements of mining equipment. Inside, and without being detected, they split into two teams. One team went forward towards the bridge, and the second secured the engine room. It had gone off like clockwork, and the general had a large grin on his face as he heard the words, "Surrender your vessel." "Nice try, cadets." Sarah's weak compliment needed dissecting.
"I'm sorry?"
"Well, you guys did take over the ship, but you used a lot of the same tactics you used last time. We've made some adjustments too, you know."
"So you won't surrender?" he asked in a dark voice.
This had gone off perfectly. "They have the ship," Sean told himself.
"Sure. I'll surrender the ship, but as you can see, it's all locked up."
She was right. A quick glance at the instrument showed the locked icon flashing.
"I'll give you a clue, cadets. The flashbang on the bridge.
Sorry about that."
"Well," Terry was trying to salvage the situation, "we can force everyone to cooperate or there's going to be consequences."
"There, now I have you," she tried convincing herself.
"If things aren't fixed pretty quick," Sarah warned, "the star maps are the first things to be dumped. The good doctor's photo catalog has been secured with a 512-bit cipher key, so even if you do manage to get ship's control, you don't know where you are or where to go."
"We might have that info on our ship," she argued.
"You might," Sarah conceded.
"I think you all did an excellent job," the general complimented his team.
"Thank you, sir," multiple cadets replied. The cadets had been performing many raids such as this. They were also burning through most of the fuel, seeing as the Calico barely moved these days.
"I think I'd call that a success, General," John said with admiration. "They've been doing a lot of training, and it appears to be working. Our ship doesn't stand much of a chance against our Marines."
John began using the term once the cadets started serious war games. If they were not attacking the Calico, they were attacking the miners or each other. The suits had taken a lot of punishments from hard knocks out on the asteroids where they practiced, but other than the scratches and a few gouges, the armor was holding up well, for having been printed here on the ship. The reinforced plastic that the removable layer of the suits were made from was only one type of material available for the printer. It had a wide selection of nozzles, heating elements, and materials, including metals. The thing itself was big. A 5-foot by 5-foot base that could make something 8 foot tall if necessary. A voice was heard over the intercom system.
"John, your presence along with Sarah's is requested in the conference room. I think they made a decision about objects of interest."
John sighed.
Turning to leave the bridge, he looked at Sarah and asked, "You want a coffee?" The auto drill was an invention that was dreamed up by some scientists at Caltech. A three-legged device that could move under its own power and jump around from site to site. The feet had spikes that could be fired into the rock surface to hold the unit fixed and later were removed by a second explosion in the opposite direction. It worked, kind of. If the terrain was composed of loose material, then the drill made note and moved on. A mobile team would decide whether to return. The drill had a vertical pole in the middle that was capable of drill depths down to 15 feet, but the only way for it to remove the cutting was an in-and-out movement. Cut, lift, analyze, spin and throw, repeat. It took time, but the units did work, and being fully automatic meant the people on the ground were not babysitting them. The drills gave them enough data to make decisions about which holes were worth further investigation. It was after returning to the ship, having repaired a broken drill, that Sarah asked her father to go to the conference room ASAP. God, are the cadets taking over the ship again? John could only wonder before saying, I'll be right there, just stowing my things. He made his way to the room on the ring, and seeing Sarah's guard was on duty today, was about to ask permission to enter, when the young man suddenly gave the door two quick raps with his knuckles and swung the door open. The cadet wore an anxious look on his face. Pondering the meaning of this for a second, John fished in his pocket, found what he was after, and finally stepped in to see that Shannon was there as well, seated across from his daughter. Unassumingly, he lit up the cigarette and sat down. The looks of disapproval that he received from both parties quickly faded after Sarah blurted out, Dad, we just started receiving a radio signal. Pausing to look at her for several moments, his gaze finally shifted over to Shannon for a more detailed explanation. It's a repetitive signal, centered around the 318 megahertz band, spread spectrum and modulated. Though no sound came out, the two women could read the word that formed on his lips as he leaned his head back and blew the cloud of smoke towards the vent. Wow. Calico Archives. John's first thought was for the safety of the ship. He knew what the two women in front of him were thinking. The same thing I'm thinking. Let's go see. However, the problem was that they had no way to protect themselves. Well, they had weapons, but they were securely locked away behind a code that only the president possessed. Sarah, we need that authorization code. Agreed. That's why Rachel is in the process of getting her on the line. Good girl, flashed in his mind. I'd also like it to be you that argues the point. You're the captain of this ship, and you need to defend it, her father emphasized. Fine. Who else do we need on this call? She asked. Weapons, bridge, perhaps a good doctor and his fine optics? Okay. She highlighted the CIC button on her pad and pressed comms. Major Shepherd, are you there?
Go for Shepherd, was the response in the voice of Dr. Schubert.
Oh, good. Doctor, you are there. Can I have you and the Major report to the conference room on the double?
Yes, ma'am, came the reply. Both were aware of the signal.
Mr. Shepherd, any word about that drone of yours? She asked.
Nadine is just readying it. Should be out the door in a minute or two.
The two CIC officers that had accompanied the Calico were off the same destroyer. In fact, the weapons installed on the Calico were from that ship as well. It had been a decommissioning that managed to put a few of the old components back into action. That was what they were hoping to do, anyway.
Who's on the bridge? John asked.
Marty.
Good. I'd say leave him in charge and you look after the big picture.
Cadet.
Sarah spoke in an elevated voice.
Connor Murphy opened the door.
Yes, ma'am.
Pass the word for Major Smith to join us, would you? Thanks.
John quickly jumped in. and a coffee and water serving for six.
Yes, sir.
Connor grinned as he closed the door. The conference room was situated on the ring, which constituted several areas on the ship that had some sort of gravity. 1/4 Earth gravity, to be exact, but it was better than nothing. The ring circled the inside of the ship and spun on air bearings. There were 2 additional counter-rotating collars on either side of the ring to keep the ship from wanting to precess. The door opened while Rachel came on the screen.
I have the president for you.
Rachel, stay on the line, but let's make sure this call is private.
Okay, Dad.
Amazingly, the coffee was the first thing through the door, followed immediately by the 3 requested guests. When everyone was settled and the door closed, Sarah turned her face to the screen.
Madam President, I'm sorry to disturb you, but we have news and a request.
Very well, Sarah. Proceed.
I don't know who all is with you, but you may want to hold this news in private.
I'm here with the Joint Chiefs. Go ahead.
Yes, ma'am.
9 minutes ago, we began receiving a radio signal, repetitive in nature and modulated. Rachel has uploaded the file to your shared space, and we would like you to analyze it if you can.
We can't.
Would you call this a beacon signal? Asked General Smith.
Sir, we don't know what it is, but we are under that assumption.
Yes, sir.
Why do I have a feeling that analyzing the signal is not the request? Voiced the president.
No, ma'am, it's not. We plan to go investigate, but I would humbly request the activation code for the weapon system. We are going in blind, and all we can do is run. We need to be able to defend ourselves.
Mr. West, this isn't another of your stunts like you pulled on Mars, is it? There are still people pissed off about that little charade.
No, ma'am.
As his cheek reddened slightly, John found himself straightening in his chair. Clearing his throat, he said, "The signal is not from us. In fact, the 2 majors, Shepard and Nadine, launched the passive drone to see if we can get a baseline. But I don't think we're there just yet."
Major?
The president hinted.
Ma'am, it's out about 27 miles, perpendicular, to the direction the pulses appear to be originating from. The angle hasn't changed yet.
And what does that indicate to you, Major?
Well, ma'am, the unit has a directional antenna, and if the signal always points in one direction, no matter how far the probe moves away at right angles to it, then the signal is a long way away.
I see. Yes, that makes sense. Fine. I'll give you a 1-day temporary code. Sarah interrupted here.
Madam President, look, you either trust us with these systems or you don't. If something happens after the 24-hour period and we lose comms, then we are right back where we are now. Please trust us.
Trust me. The President stared back for a long, drawn-out moment, then relented.
Don't make me wish I hadn't done this, Captain.
The reference to a non-existent title was meant to convey something to Sarah, but she heard it so often from her father and several other of the crew that it rolled right off without her even noticing. With the code entered, the naval officers began to check all the weapons at their disposal. It was not insignificant. Sarah had already issued a recall to the personnel on the ground, but it was going to take time for them to get organized, equipment stored, and then picked up. To this point, none of the ground personnel or the pilot was aware of what had happened, and for now she was going to keep it that way.
Get them all back first, she thought to herself.
Sarah, I recommend we test out every system. There's no point having it at the ready if we don't know that it actually works.
Dad's right, she thought,
then advanced.
Sure.
Makes sense.
Test them how?
Well, we need a target.
Major Shepard piped up now.
We've been tracking a small asteroid outside the main lane. In fact, it would work really well. There's barely any spin. We can align Dr. Schubert's telescopes with our targeting software.
Doctor, Sarah looked over at him.
Do you have any issue with using your scopes to aim our guns?
No, Captain. Being someone who always referred to her as Captain, simply because he didn't know any better. We've played around doing just that many times. It will require some fine-tuning.
Well, no time like the present. Commander, she said in earnest.
Marty looked up.
Yes, ma'am.
Please consult with Navigation and CIC and put together a plan to test each of the weapon systems. Shepard, did you give the rock a designation for Nav?
Yes, ma'am. We cataloged it as Target 827.
Easy enough, she said, and selected the bridge from her list of choices. Bridge, plot a course to Target 827 in the catalog, please.
Course plotted. Recommend step 120.
120, standby. Engineering, are you guys spun up?
We're running some diagnostics on the core, but you can have step 2 at any time.
How soon before your testing is done?
5 minutes if we abbreviate them.
You can give me 120 right now?
Yes, Captain. And the diagnostics aren't mandatory, so we'll abort the long ones and have it back up in 10 minutes.
Very good, thanks. Where's Jimmy?
He's got shuttle duty.
Sarah, the president chimed in.
What is step 120 all about?
I was under the impression that step 4 was the limit. Yes, ma'am, Sarah said with a smile. Navigation has recommended that we use step 1 with 20% thrust to get there. The object is about as far away as the moon is from you.
Yes, I see. A bit of shorthand.
Comms, give me an open channel to the ship. Leave the shuttle out of it for now.
Go ahead, Sarah.
Crew of the Calico, about 15 minutes ago, we began receiving a radio transmission from an unknown source, and we plan to go investigate. The President has authorized our use of the weapons package installed prior to the launch, and we are making plans to run a series of tests on those guns to find out how well they work. We will be going to yellow alert once we are mobile, but we will need to transition to red alert to test fire the weapons. We will be operating from yellow 3 and red 3. Let's all review our stations during those alert levels so we aren't all bumping into one another. Stand by for the next update.
Comm, put me through to the ground crew, would you?
Go ahead.
James, are you there?
Always, came his chipper reply.
Status on evac? Sarah asked.
15 minutes and we'll get everybody on board and 2 more auto drills to shut down. What's up?
Tell you when you get up here. For now, we are repositioning the ship to test fire the weapon system.
He's going to freak over that statement, she thought.
The conference room was broken down into 2 groups. Marty and his team were finalizing the planned test, then rendezvous with the ground crew, and finally the search grid. The plan was to travel a certain distance, stop, and reassess. Each time, the point would be triangulated as best they could and then repeat. It was expected not to take over 10 tries, but that was only a guess. John finished scrawling a note to Sarah on his pad and hit send. The alert caused her to look down then back up at him.
Makes sense, she thought, then asked, Doctor, how close do we have to get to the source of the radio signal to be able to get a decent view?
1,000 kilometers will give you a nice solid render, he mused.
At what scale are we talking, Doctor? She asked, wanting data.
30 meters would be about the size of a postage stamp, he concluded.
So if we want to see human activity, how close do we have to be? She urged.
Around 100 kilometers would make for a nice, easy-to-understand picture.
Thanks, Doctor. Marty, what's your status? She asked.
We have a plan disseminated and ready to load into the procedure log. Just waiting on final approval, he stated with a look of confidence.
Well, let's see if your team knows what they are doing. Mr. Smith,
Light up the ship and initiate your plan. Let me know when we are within 100 kilometers of the radio source, if you please.
As the realization of what was being asked settled in, Marty's heart began to race. Then, in a confident tone, he finally committed to the word, "Understood."
"Com, give me shipwide," Sarah demanded of the slab of glass in her hand.
"Go ahead."
"Crew of the Calico, we have a plan in the works to first test the weapons, retrieve the skiff, and find the signal. Commander Smith has the bridge."
With that said, she moved Marty Smith's name to the top of the list. Panels throughout the ship indicated that Marty was in command of the Calico. An occurrence had happened regularly, but this was new. General Smith sat there with glowing pride as he watched his son take command of not just any ship, but an honest-to-goodness starship. The Calico had certainly obtained the rank as the vessel's new weapon system were brought online. Two turreted 5-inch guns, along with four of the Phalanx close-in weapon systems. They had all been severely modified to work with the hull design, but there they were, all certified functional. There was also a selection of missiles that could be deployed, but the three that mattered the most were called DUDs. The DUDs were nuclear-tipped, long-range missiles with selectable yield rates from 1 to 20 kilotons. The general had been instrumental in getting the okay to loan out the systems and having them installed.
"You're not sending my son out there on a ship with no protection," he had said threateningly. "We know how to do it, and we're going to do it right."
Everyone was satisfied with the results of the tests, and after a quick stop to pick up a thoroughly depressed chief engineer and his passengers, the ship began the search in earnest.
White House Papers. Susan Capshaw had not become president because she was slow. When she was handed the piece of paper, she quickly scanned it and agreed. This might very well be the best time to try.
"Rachel," she called out.
"Yes, ma'am."
"I have just been informed that Page is most likely going to be deposed in a congressional hearing, but we don't know the date or time. Is it okay to get her on the Earth-Mars run for the time being, in the event she is suddenly needed? It is my understanding there will be 3 days advance notice given. Is that all right?" she asked pleadingly.
"Sure, but if you really need her there, I can divert the BJ and have her over on the moon this evening."
"That is sweet, but unnecessary. Let her keep working, and hopefully the date can be firmed up in a day or two."
"Sure, sounds good," she continued.
"It's really pretty exciting, isn't it?" Rachel added to the talk.
"Yes, it really is," Capshaw agreed. "Securing a step drive tops everything," she thought as she smiled to herself.
Page would recognize the deposition reference as code for her and her team to get ready. The pieces were being moved around on the board in just such a way whereby, if the opportunity presented itself, the plan would be put into action. There had been a lot of time, effort, and planning put into how this little heist could be pulled off. If there was a large enough distraction, the plan had a high chance of success, and whatever was behind this signal might very well provide them with their best opportunity yet. Calico made 3 triangulation moves that defined the source in 3D space. Now they were repositioning the ship to the desired distance to get a better look with the scopes. Dr. Schubert was someone the president knew little about. She was aware of the rendering scopes, how it had taken so much time and effort to mount, and how President Bishop had purchased the package from the doctor along with his time just for this ship. The results everyone was seeing was truly worth it. Each of the doctor's telescopes consists of a small footprint, lightweight Newtonian, set on gimbals. The primary mirror, being of exceptional quality, blended with advanced light folding techniques, kept each unit small
but their focal lengths long. The individual scopes can be combined with others in the array to either improve overall coverage or increase the resolution. The units fit snugly into individual recesses on the compression coils that encircle the outside of the Calico's hull, and when the ship is not on step, the array is scanning the local star field or concentrating on nearby or distant objects. We're at 100 clicks, Sarah. Firing up the scopes. Stand by. Everyone was absorbed watching the monitor. Then the picture came through. It was a ship. The hole in the side was obvious, as well as the small, featureless creatures that were moving near to where the beacon signal was being highlighted on the display. It also appeared to be towing something behind it, like a large sack. But now, it was broken, laying against a rather largish asteroid. "It appears," voiced Sarah, "that this has just turned into a rescue mission." A pause, then, "Doctor, how many different views do you need to create your render?"
"I should think that 6 will do the trick. We can only see one side of the ship, so yes, 6.
"Okay, get with the bridge and put us where you need to be to get those shots."
"Yes, of course," the doctor stammered a bit, not sure who to talk to next. Fortunately, everybody was listening, and navigation called up CIC. The maneuver only took 12 minutes, and the ship was back at its starting point, quietly resting while the good doctor's software rendered out a 3D model from the pictures.
"Bridge, CIC. We analyzed the pulses coming from behind the ship, and we think it's another beacon. However, the frequency changes based on what's around it, and then there's the fact that it's well hidden."
"What do you mean?" Marty asked.
"The unit is situated amongst a rubble pile, as if someone went out of their way to make sure it was hard to locate."
"You said it changes frequency?"
"Yes. We've watched several small asteroids pass by, and the frequency is altered each time."
"Sounds like a mousetrap to me, and that ship is a bait," Rachel interjected from afar.
"Now that you mention it, yeah, I see your point. Do you guys see anything around we could use to test Rachel's trap idea?"
Marty's joke had meaning.
"You mean like asteroids?"
called out an unknown voice. Laughter ensued. They were still in the same stream of rocks and dust, 80 light minutes from where they had started. This thing was massive. The job fell to the cadets, who were very well versed in what was about to happen next. They had used a similar tactic to attack the Calico not much more than 2 days ago. It was decided that the body needed to be large and slow-moving. If there was a trap, it likely needed a guinea pig willing to stick around for a while. A nice-sized candidate floated a mere 3 kilometers from the wreck. Using the skiff, the team approached the rock from the blind side, and once there, the tiny ship's thrusters were adjusted to create the desired momentum. Then it was back to the Calico for a round of high fives and accolades from the people seated around the table in the White House. It took over an hour, but the trap was sprung. The stranded beings watched in horror as this shattered remnant of something far larger passed within 30 meters of their already broken ship. As it meandered past the startled onlookers, another vessel suddenly appeared. It was big, scary-looking, and ready to attack. Being nearly 3 times the size of the Calico, the humans were duly impressed. Marty had perched the ship in a different location to get the best vantage point as the asteroid moved along its new path. They were sitting dark. No emissions. The power plant idled with minimum output, with the batteries fully charged. If they needed to go, they could, but for now, they sat there watching, invisible in their surroundings to most any kind of sensor other than lasers. If they got nailed by that, then all bets were off. This new ship remained for an additional minute, then departed. With only passive sensors, not much data could be gleaned, but one thing they did know. The good doctor's 360-degree field photos indicated
a distant light that disappeared and reappeared. "We see you," he gleefully thought to himself. The plan was straightforward. Record a segment of beacon signal, destroy the beacon, and broadcast the recording. Simple.
"I know about the delay from when the button is pressed to when the bullets hit," Shannon told Marty impatiently. "You're like the 10th person." "Okay, I'm exaggerating, but for crying out loud," she thought to herself.
"Well, then fire at your own discretion," Marty's voice lacked confidence. Shannon immediately pressed the button. 30 rounds belched out of the gun, and 2.8 seconds later slammed into and obliterated the beacon. The broadcast was up and appeared to be at the same amplitude. The Calico was at its highest alert level. All the guns were loaded, and the reactor was healthy and ready to supply all the power they would ever need. With a significant number of people watching and waiting with bated breath, nothing happened. The speck of light in the distance was still there. No significant change in the mass monitoring that was regularly being performed now. It looked good. They waited a full half hour before repositioning to advance on the crippled ship and crew. The approach was slow and methodical. A searchlight had been used to signal their arrival, then dimmed to simply provide area lighting. The isolation pod was the trickiest thing to deploy. Sarah's idea. If there was ever an infection that needed mass quarantine of personnel, this pod had been built to do just that. Essentially a tube in a tube with end caps that were fitted after leaving the storage bay. It basically had the means of pressurizing the interior, supplying power and heat, along with a medical room that people could make their way into via a short hallway where sterilization measures could be applied. Essentially, people in quarantine were in the middle of the tube, and people needing medical attention were around the outside. The mass around the outside could be altered, allowing for the pod to be balanced, which was important because the unit was designed to be rotated and provide near-Earth gravity. The Calico had parked close enough for the beings to watch the activity. First, the inner tube was ejected from the hold, then the secondary hull was mated. As the work progressed, one of the two domed ends were attached, then the second end was fitted. It was obvious that this end was a large door that could be closed. Once completed, the two occupants guided the craft down to an area near to where the active beacon stood. The door had remained open throughout the short flight and appeared as an invitation. The beings had little choice. Their ship was crippled, with its power soon to run out, and the life support in their suits could not sustain them much longer.
"A glimmer of hope?" each wondered. This vessel, high above them, was unlike any ship they had ever seen before. Certainly not the type of ship that had been attacking their supply vessels and stealing the contents, including the workers. With slow resignation, they all made their way into the tube and waited. The two suited individuals watched them patiently. After the last of the newcomers were inside, they watched as one of them stepped up to the clear wall separating the two species. Removing a hose from the front of the suit, it held the end against an indented area in the wall. This brought up a colorful display that seemed to indicate levels of what it found. The being was prompting them to do the same to the patch on their side. A member of the group attempted to do just that, but was unable to get the fitting to release. After some frustration, a larger volunteer pushed past, pulled the hose from its suit, and put it in position. A colored screen of the same type appeared on its side. It took a little bit of prodding, but the correct alignment and force produced the results Sarah was looking for. She then gestured to the volunteer to follow her as she made her way to the end of the tube with the open door. There was nothing difficult about operating it. Swing it shut and turn the handle to engage the rod, which kept the door shut. Having completed this task, she walked everyone back over to where they started, and using her panel, turned on the flow of oxygen and nitrogen that would make up her atmosphere. It happened rather quickly, and once her side was pressurized, Sarah took off her activity suit and stood there, smiling. Arms folded, she would raise one occasionally and wave. One of the beings had taken an interest in the colored screen and gestured to it. Sarah brought up a periodic table for each side and began to draw out how it should be interpreted. The being pointed to the graph showing the level of oxygen the sensors had detected, and she promptly pointed to the location on the table. The nitrogen was also there. It pointed to the water and carbon dioxide levels, and Sarah went through the process of showing their structure. The humans watched as the being turned to the big volunteer. Grabbing the arm, it looked at the readings from the display on the wrist. This resulted in wild gestures that were comical but unreadable. The being turned back to Sarah. It gestured for a different volunteer, and when the correct one was found, the hose from its suit was put against the pad and a new reading taken. After examining the results, they appeared to be ready for the next step. As Sarah pointed out, it was to press the colored shape on the panel. This complete, Sarah indicated to the ports located around the inside of the tube where the air was being pushed out. By holding her hand next to a port on her side, showing that the tube was filling with the desired content. Several of the visitors did the same. Holding their hand against the port, they could feel the rush of air against the suit. "Maybe we might live after all," several of the stranded individuals thought. White House Papers.
"Well, that explains the wild arm gestures," Dr. Kurt Landau spoke with a degree of understanding. He was the president's science advisor and friend. Having met in college, he had ridden her coattails into the White House, and now this relationship was affording him a front-row seat at the most amazing spectacle he had ever witnessed.
"I'm sorry, what was that, Kurt?" the president asked, transfixed by all that was taking place. "Astonishing barely fits as a descriptor," she thought to herself.
"Those CO2, humidity, and temp levels are way off. If he were human, he would be unconscious or dead. I'm guessing they were all getting close to losing life support."
"So you're calling that one a him?" she asked, unable to turn away from the screen.
"Honestly, ma'am, I don't know what to make of any of this. It's unbelievable."
"Yes, but we know it's happening. We can at least agree on that, right?"
"I believe it's happening, but..." His thoughts were cut short. "Wait, I think the big guy is being ordered out of its suit." The helmet came off, and to the surprise of everyone, they had much the same skeletal features as the humans. The skin, a deep red hue, appeared thicker and tougher than what the humans were accustomed to seeing. The eyes, nearly black and somewhat farther apart. Then there was the hair, or what stood in for hair. It appeared to be composed of tiny pin feathers that lay against the scalp. A unique appearance, but nothing the humans found unattractive about the look. The being took a deep breath, and the facial features seemed to relax. The second being, whose air had been sampled, also took off its helmet. These features appeared to be more feminine than the big one. Facing Marty, he found the creature very pretty. Marty reached down with his one gloved hand and removed the other to show his hands and fingers. He then reached out and placed his palm on the glass separating them. A new display lit up near his hand, showing his pulse, blood oxygenation level, and temperature. After seeing this, the one in charge said something to the group, and the being removed its glove and followed suit. The hand also had 5 digits with a similar bone structure. Once the hand was on the panel, an identical response occurred on the glass. Heart rate appears faster, but no surprise there, thought Dr. Landau. Sarah was showing her counterpart how to use a glass to draw pictures using its finger, and a dialogue opened. It was determined that 3 of the beings were injured and still on the ship, unable to be put into suits.
Calico, you there?
Go ahead, Captain.
Have Rami shuttle over 3 of the largest inflatable life pods, would you?
Sure will. Stand by.
The beings were paying close attention to their rescuers and appeared to have contacted the other ship. Each wondered what would happen next. Sarah's drawing was beginning to be understood, and the one in charge checked the readings of 4 of the other beings' suits' life support levels. A quick exchange and they moved towards the door. The airlock was obvious, and its operations simple enough. Once through, they began making their way back to the ship, just as the skiff appeared next to the pod.
Where do you want the ILP, Skipper?
James Nance's voice was heard over the loop.
Hang on, came the reply.
Sarah was drawing again, indicating that she planned on having the skiff move to where the hole in the side of the ship would allow for easier access. The one in charge seemed to agree, but the wild gesturing began again in earnest. Several of the crew seemed to be going nuts about something that brought on additional noises and head movements from the others. The one in charge turned back to Sarah's drawing and started her own rendition.
Wow, he's pissed about something.
Maggie Jones had accepted the chief of staff position offered by the president-elect, and after 9 years in the role, was extremely comfortable with everyone she had to deal with. She had known the young woman who was currently communicating with another species for over 4 of those years.
If it is a him, then yeah, something's riled him up, Kurt responded. Well, until I know better, the big one's a he, and the one the major is making time with is a she.
He does seem intrigued, doesn't he? The president nodded.
You see what he's done there? Asked Kurt. He's taught her how to distinguish between good and bad with a thumbs up or thumbs down. Very smart.
Yes, that visual wall is an excellent way to communicate, isn't it?
Oh, I see. It's the beacon they destroyed that's got them all worked up.
Sarah pressed the glowing circle on the wall, and the speaker system between the two spaces activated. The first recorded vocal communication with an alien species was about to occur.
No,
she said to the being on the other side of the glass, and stood there shaking her head.
The being's auditory system closely matches, so this sound, which obviously came from the being, was meant to indicate something, but what's with the head movement? It looks painful, thought the Talon on the other side of the glass.
Bridge.
Another word that makes no sense.
Go ahead.
A reply from the ship. Simple enough sounds.
Pipe down the video recording of the events leading up to the beacon getting blasted into dust.
Madam President, I think this is a good time to continue on with the day's schedule.
Maggie needed this off her plate, and everyone seemed content to spend the rest of the day watching TV.
So right. What's next on the list?
Item 7, the Sunrise Project.
Do the Joint Chiefs or DOD need to be in on this meeting?
No, ma'am. They're up to speed. This is just a refresher. Paige and her team will be arriving back at the Mars Complex tomorrow morning. The window opens when you call Rachel at 9:30 a.m., giving her team time to get to storage. Once recalled and the crates relocated, she will disable the radio system on the Hijastro prior to leaving. She plans on refueling before arriving at the base.
Will that arouse any suspicions?
Asked the president.
Paige says it's her call, and with the extra bodies she'll have with her, it only makes sense to do it that way.
What kind of roadblocks do we foresee?
Very few. The plan is to stow the cadets' dunnage in the storeroom until they are situated. Then, when they are recalled, along with Paige, they simply swap out the containers and move them back to the ship. It's really quite elegant how this has come together.
Are we ready on our end? She asked.
Yes, ma'am. We have a jet already at the airport, fueled and ready to leave for Colorado at a moment's notice. Once the transfer from the bridge occurs,
The crate should be in the air within 30 minutes and in the vault within 4 hours.
Excellent. You all have done great work getting us to this point. What's next?
Rami had never left the pilot's seat. She held the skiff orientated so that the hole in the ship lined up with the door. James, on the other hand, got out and began looking around at the damage. It had to have been 2 shots. The first one punched a big hole in the side of the ship, and then the second shot was targeted at the coupling between the reactor and the electrical generator, he realized. Jim watched as the door opened to the front section of the ship, and the 3 inflated ILPs floated through with 1 person holding each. It was a simple matter moving them into the skiff, getting them secured, and then it was back to the pod. Moving them into the hospital section was accounted for in the design. 4 separate tubes had been installed as airlocks, and they were currently being loaded with the ILPs and their occupants. They had also gathered a significant number of additional supplies that were being moved into the other section through the airlock. It was a long process, but faster than pulling down a vacuum and opening the big door. The one who appeared to be in charge was already in the other side of the glass with Sarah, who was wearing a mask and gloves at this point. Once all the supplies were accounted for, the alien donned a similar look. They then set about moving the injured personnel into the clinic through the hatches. As it turned out, there were 2 injuries and a pregnancy, but the activity of the day had brought on the female's labor and the moans of her suffering. 1 certainly had a broken arm and leg, and 1 was unconscious with an obvious head wound. The video of the birthing process, along with the X-ray data, were transmitted back to Earth. The MRI scans had to be hand-delivered. It was just too much data to send over the relay. There were going to be a lot of interested people who would want access to all of it. Originally, the request had been made to Sarah by the scientific community to try and get a few DNA samples that could be sectioned and studied. The final accumulation of differing body fluids became at first a treasure trove, and then a deluge. There was a lot thrown away. After the birth and the bones set, Sarah had Marty spin up the pod, and they all got to feel gravity again. This was going to help in the operation that was being prepared for. The scans indicated that the crushed skull was exerting a significant amount of pressure on the brain, and it needed to be cut away. The procedure was not beyond the scope of Sarah's little clinic, but she was out of her depth. An expert was called in, and he walked Sarah and Rayleigh through it. With a section of skull removed, a laser scanner mapped the hole left behind, and a replacement portion of skull was printed out of sterile plastic. It was a perfect fit, and the epoxy resin bonded the part in place. The excitement of the day began to wind down as visitors were treated to an assortment of pictures and videos of Earth and its many cultures. The plumbing in the pod was tested and found satisfactory to the guests, who had all taken time to shower and use the facilities. A second run by the skiff returned outerwear to make them all comfortable, and for James and his alien counterpart to take measurements of the shafts that the coupling used to connect. Jim had his team draw up a design that received a thumbs up and was sent off to the metal 3D printer for construction. This was going to take about 30 hours to finalize, but they had time, and everyone seemed to be getting along. As the lights were turned down, and everyone settled in for a peaceful night's sleep, the spinning drum's silence was occasionally broken by a snort as the newest member of this unlikely gathering suckled at her mother's breast. Calico Archives.
"Well, that was weird," Rachel said, her face reappearing on the screen.
"Meaning?"
Shannon inquired.
"The president just recalled Paige for that deposition thing."
"Yeah, so?"
"Well, those new cadets are going back with her. A screw-up. She made it sound like they were meant to go back to the States instead, but they somehow ended up on her Mars flight. Anyway,
Strange thing is that the president herself called to tell me about Paige and the cadets. She did offer to pay double for the mishap, but still, doesn't that seem odd? Rachel, you know how I feel about Paige. She's DOD, she's got those glasses of hers that we've seen her use, and I know she's a really good pilot and a friend of yours, but I just don't trust her.
This was not the first time Shannon had warned about Paige, but she was liked, and other than her taking some pictures with her glasses, there was nothing to indicate anything squirrely about her.
How soon before the ship is fixed? Asked Rachel, knowing full well all she had to do was look up Jimmy's logs. Tomorrow, sometime. James says there needs to be some realignment of the two shafts before hooking up the coupling, so he and Talis are working through how to do that now. Then we are going to give them some of our O2, which must be pumped over. Not sure how they plan on doing that. I'm staying out of it.
Make any new friends? Rachel asked, a bit jealous.
Marty has been doing most of the work, but we do have several linguists on Earth that are working to create translations based on what he's gotten from him so far. Isn't it wonderful, though? This entire experience has been worth everything.
Shannon's voice drifted off as she saw the speck on the screen create a new energy line, then move.
There it goes again, she noted. Trevor still thinks it's an artifact of the coils, like possibly a breakdown of the insulation or something. I don't know.
Watching dots move around on a screen was not one of Rachel's favorite things to do, and she decided on a mission of her own.
Yeah, he and I talked about it, but it's the vector displacement that gets me.
Shannon knew that Rachel's eyes were glazing over by now.
Anyway, I'm going to see what I can figure out, Rachel mused.
Okay, I'll let you go. Talk to you later. And the conversation ended. Because there was so much debris from all the asteroids, it was getting hard to tell if the mass tension line was just jumping from rock to rock, or was it truly something going on with the compression coils? If they were acting up, she wanted to be closer to home if they broke.
There it goes again.
Her anxiety was beginning to match her frustration as she watched the dot jump around.
It's got to be something else. Why just that dot? Or so it seems.
Her latest gadget tracked the tension lines that were contacting the coils on step. It was the same phenomenon that allowed her to discover the glasses Paige wore. The coils were constantly interacting with the force lines being encountered, including all the little lines generated by the very matter the ship and people and water and things were made up of, and the energy transformations happening with all of it. These levels were small, like background noise, but occasionally a large spike would occur, and the coils would sense it. Her software would then try to identify its location in three-dimensional space, and if it looked like a problem, the ship would try to avoid it. In the case of Paige, the spikes recorded by the Hijastro flight system showed them to be inside the vessel. Just moving around causes a chaotic realignment of these tension forces. Playing around with the data by overlapping onboard video to the 3D energy readings showed that these spikes were occurring on the front of Paige's face, namely her glasses. Shannon had first seen it on Paige's flight between Earth and Mars, then again on the Hijastro when the spare step drive was broken. The thought brought back a flood of emotion, not the least of which was the embarrassment of personally breaking a step drive.
It was an accident, she reassured herself, before returning her thoughts to the energy plot and the knot in her stomach. Whatever it is, I don't think it's the coils or the software.
John had settled on spending most of his time helping the engineering team get the coupling built and patching the hole in the side of the ship. Cutting out a proper shape from the jagged hole that first occupied the space was a trivial task for the torch. Then it was shaping a piece of aluminum sheet that was available and securing it to where the hole once stood. The result was not perfect,
but the ship could hold an atmosphere again, and that was what was important. Sarah, on the other hand, spent most of her time supervising the isolation pod and its occupants. She and Rowley had spent enough time together where they had developed a rudimentary language of their own, consisting of grunts, pokes, pulls, finger gestures, and the occasional attempt at using the other's verbiage. The patients were recovering. The baby, satisfied for the time being, rested on its own. The mother was up and about, spending time with the patient recovering from the head wound. He had awoken, finding himself strapped down in an unknown place, looking at an alien creature wearing a mask. It took a bit to settle him down, but now he was sitting up and drinking fluids on his own. The other one was starting to get on Sarah's nerves. Having conceded the fact that he was better at checkers than she was, they moved on to chess. It was clear she was not going to hold victory status much longer there, either. Maybe poker, she pondered out of desperation. After a long discussion with her father and a significant number of people on Earth, she relented to Marty's request, and he and his new friend Miasha were sequestered in a small room forward of the control station. They were without the PPE that the medics wore and were basically in close contact with one another. They remained in this little room, observed by anyone who wanted, continuing to advance the language skills started the previous day. "Sarah, you need to top up your oxygen, and the sooner the better," she heard her father say as he looked at the pod's info display on the wall in engineering. "Just tell them not to freak out, and let's get that tub moving."
"Yes, father, she gets it."
"We are just wanting to keep the baby from floating away and hitting something." "You can't just give it to the mother and tell her to hold it?" John reflected on the child. "The lungs on that kid makes your teeth vibrate."
"Okay, we are going to spin down the pod and get ready to move. Did you guys figure out how to fit us into the hold?"
"Yep, we shuffled a few things around. You can slide right in. It won't take but a half hour, so if they're uncomfortable, you can move right back over to the beacon when you're done."
"They're fine. Okay?
We should be moving in a couple of minutes." "One less headache to worry about," John told himself, then addressed the engineer. "James, I'm headed to the bridge. See if Candy wants a break."
"Shannon, did you see that?" CIC demanded.
"What?"
"That mass tension dot thing you've been tracking. It just got bigger."
"Yes, it has.
A whole lot bigger. What the hell?"
The Pitner's stomach grew deeper.
"Okay, I think," she said to no one.
John had just stepped onto the bridge when Rachel called.
"Rachel, what's up?"
"Dad, we've been robbed."
Everyone on the bridge heard what she had said and turned to look.
"Robbed?
Rachel, go private." John made his way into the little room just off the bridge where no recording devices were active. There were several of these privacy rooms available, reason being, there were not many places on the ship that weren't monitored, except for these small rooms and the individual quarters. There were times when talking to Rachel or whoever in private was necessary, so having a few places scattered around throughout the ship meant he did not have far to go to find one.
"Rachel, are you there?" he asked.
"Dad, the distortion field generators are gone, and there's only one person who could have taken them, and that's Paige."
White House papers.
"Shit, shit, shit!"
Susan Capshaw swore out loud. She knew that she had oversold it when the previous day's call to Mars base was complete. Now she saw the looks of concern on the faces around her and the sinking feeling in her stomach. Sarah's voice could be heard in the background calling out distances.
"Turn that down. I need to think," Susan demanded.
The order was obeyed, but there was not much to think about as Marcy Cooper piped up her assessment.
"Madam President, we are in stage 4. The plane is in the air and will be landing in Colorado in 45 minutes. We also have verification that the plane is compromised,
but salvageable. We need to initiate the lockdown.
The president looked at her director of Department of Defense.
Marcy, what kind of blowback can I expect from doing that?
Susan was not at all comfortable about this part of the plan.
The log shows that nobody had looked in those cases for the past 6 months. If only I had played my part better.
Susan's embarrassment showed.
Madam President, the ship and crew are scheduled to arrive back here in approximately 1 month's time. If it were only John West being able to remotely destroy those drives, that would be one thing. We could set up the protection transmitters and simply reset the radio link until we were satisfied that the assets are safely in the vault. But now we have a bigger problem.
How so?
The weapon system activation code that you gave them, ma'am.
Marcy still could not believe that she, of all people, would do that.
He has 3 live nuclear-tipped missiles under his command, and we would be powerless to stop him from taking out Washington, New York, L.A. And remember, it has been our contention from the start that he likely has the capability to shut down his radio system at any time, stopping our ability to deactivate those weapon systems remotely, no matter what he says. Madam President, we need to act now.
All right, fine. Let's do this, she acquiesced. I'm ordering the DOD asset deactivation protocol for Western Wave's equipment. This resulted in a flurry of activity as the laptop was set up and initiated.
We still have good comms with all assets, ma'am, said the colonel, assigned the task of supporting the unit. What are your orders?
DOD asset lock.
Yes, ma'am. Waiting on confirmation. Stand by.
Marcy Cooper breathed out a sigh of relief. Several of the Joint Chiefs sat in an anteroom watching to see how this was going to play out. Sarah was going to be docking with the Calico in a few minutes, and John had just been told about the drive components. This was getting interesting.
He still has the nukes, Admiral Wynn spoke with concern.
He's not gonna use the nukes. You know this guy, Jerry. Has he ever given you any reason not to trust him? Ever?
He won't share the tech. That tells me something.
It tells me he's not sure that we can be trusted, that's all. But the idea of him using nukes on us is laughable. Besides, he would have to enlist the help of my son and several naval officers just to make it happen. Just watch how he is with the cadets. How many times have they been allowed to take control of that ship? If they had used live rounds in those weapons, which they could have, by the way, we would have that ship in our possession. No, he may be pissed, but if I know West, he will congratulate us on our ingenuity.
With intense interest, they watched as John exited the little privacy room, reassuring Rachel with the words, "It will be fine," when the call arrived from an anxious voice.
Bridge CIC.
Go.
That mass tension vector just swung around, and it's directed through the alien active beacon.
They heard John say over the comms,
Rachel, I think I need...
His voice trailed off as he stared at the screen with all the fuzzy dots.
What the hell is this?
Could be heard from one of the 2 instrument operators on the bridge, followed by,
Bridge CIC, we just received a DOD lockdown command.
What?
Candy cried, unsure of what that was.
Oh, God, the reactor,
could be heard from John as he tried to hurry his way to the door. The cadet standing there had a look of confusion on his face. Then he pointed to the screen.
A ship!
He cried as the panic level increased. John stopped his advance towards the door and followed the pointed hand. Sure enough, a large, menacing ship had suddenly appeared several 100 meters away from the beacon.
Yellow alert!
Candy cried out.
They're shooting at us!
Came the voice from CIC, and suddenly, the screen the Joint Chiefs were watching went blank, except for the words, DOD Lockdown Protocol Active.
Colonel Stuart Tennyson felt slightly claustrophobic as the group of anxious people had gathered around the unit to watch the display. The assets were aboard the ship and part of each step relay, so he had to sit there and suffer the wait as each of the confirmations were relayed back. There were 87 of those relays out there, and each were taking about a second to report in. But the cascade had begun, and as each unit reported success, it was automatically circled. Soon, everything was circled, except for the ones the colonel was forced to explain.
Wouldn't get circled, because they are all tied to the main weapons control boards which did report in. At least, that's the assumption, he thought to himself.
The two control boards, having received their command, were both destroyed. The magic smoke was released, and then they were junk. As the final dot was circled, a quick check with the plane indicated that all five units were intact. 35 minutes to touchdown. The celebrations ensued. Several fist bumps and congratulations were passed around. This was a good day. Calico Archives. The one thing about the bridge on the Calico is that it does not reside on the ring. Rushing to leave the bridge to check on the reactor got both feet off the deck and John was floating. Good way to travel if you're in a hurry and you know what you are doing. The problems arise when other ships are shooting at your ships and it suddenly gets thrown around. After bouncing off the back of the command chair, John found himself slamming into the cadet, whose feet, prior to this, were still anchored to the deck. The force of the impact sent the cadet tumbling backwards. John managed to secure a grip on the arm of the command chair, where Candy was still seated, just as the second wave of impacts hit. Once again the ship moved violently, but this time, everyone rode it out a little better. Regaining his footing, he glanced around the command area and found that Candy was looking straight at him. "I wonder if my eyes are as big as hers right now," quickly ran through his mind. It had been several seconds with no additional impacts. John gently laid his hand on Candy's forearm, and in a soft voice he said, "Just a tap on the shoulder, people. Just a tap on the shoulder to let us know they are here." "God, I hope I'm right," he mused. At that moment, a frantic call came in from Sarah.
"What the hell is happening, Bridge? If you need to, you leave. Protect my ship."
"Uh-huh," was Candy's only response. She looked back over at John. "What now?" was written all over her face as he was pointing at different things she needed to pay attention to. Soon the fog lifted, and she understood that she was still in command of the Calico.
"Engineering? What's the status with the reactor?"
She was not sure why that was so important, but he would not stop pointing at the display.
"Reactor's in good shape. We were in manual when the kill command came in."
John's face began to relax. She followed the finger location to the next display.
"Weapons, what is your status?"
"Control boards are all fried."
John couldn't take it anymore.
"Tell me you guys have a spare set hidden somewhere, and you're fixing it now."
"Yes, we did, and yes, we are," came the response from CIC.
"Do you guys still have the activation code that the president gave us earlier?"
"I've got it written down in front of me."
Candy followed up with,
"Let me know when we have weapons."
"Yes, ma'am, sure will," was the reply.
"Bridge, are you there?"
came a meek voice over the speaker.
"Go ahead, Doc."
"I've got a portion of my cameras on that big ship, and if you look closely, you can see a smaller conveyance moving away from it."
"Doc, can you transfer the controls up here?"
"Of course.
How do I do that?" he asked out of curiosity. As John talked him through this simple procedure, Candy was busy giving Sarah an update on the ship's conditions.
Once the display showed what the good doctor was seeing, they transferred the video feed over to the isolation pod for Sarah to review.
"I'm getting a lot of thumbs up and apparently happy people over here.
I believe they know each other.
Well, that's a relief, thought her father.
RFGs 1 and 2 are online,
the CIC officer alerted the bridge crew as a status display suddenly showed them to be loaded and ready to deploy. Not that they would do much good against an adversary of that size, but it was comforting to see the system slowly return. John motioned to a note he had just sent to the command chair council, which Candy quickly read.
Marines! She cried. We're at yellow alert. What's your status?
We're in staging putting on armor. We'll update at ready one.
Okay,
Candy replied. I guess, she thought. John turned and saw the flood of envy passing over the young cadet's face who was standing behind and to the left of the command chair. Don't you have some place to be, Marine? Candy caught the reference and turned to look at him.
Go,
she ordered. And with a quick thanks and a broad smile, the door opened and he was gone. White House Papers. The president and several of her advisors returned to the Situation Room, where the Joint Chiefs were still assembled. Knowing she was going to be taking some flack, Susan Capshaw put on her best game face and walked into the room. Everyone stood.
As you all know by now, I had to make a crucial decision. The drives we acquired were in danger of being destroyed, and I simply could not take that chance. As you also know, the Calico is scheduled to arrive back in our system in 4 weeks' time, and I believe, with the right spin, we can still negotiate a productive partnership with John West and his company. It's going to cost us...
The faces she had been addressing had gone from stern to a look of utter disbelief.
What?
She finally asked, not sure she wanted to know the answer.